morning. Welcome to Midday on Minnesota Public Radio. I'm Gary Eichten. Glad you could join us. This week, as you know, here on Minnesota Public Radio, we've been focusing on the issue of privacy. During our series, The Surveillance Society, we've touched on a number of different areas where surveillance and information gathering intersect with a person's expectations of privacy. Today on Midday, we're going to zero in on the workplace. Now, surveillance of employees is certainly not new. Back in the 19th century, factory owners often intruded in the personal lives of their employees, imposing nightly curfews, requiring church attendance and the like. And by the turn of the century, Henry Ford took the employer-employee relationship to something of a new level, literally spying on employees to find out how they were spending their free time. So in a sense, the issue of workplace privacy is nothing new, but there's no doubt that it's become a bigger issue as the technology to monitor employees has become more and more sophisticated. We've been joined today by a couple of experts in this field, Greg Corwin and Richard Ross. But first of all, here's Minnesota Public Radio's Bill Catlin with an overview of the issue of workplace privacy.
Drawing the line between protecting corporate interests and respecting worker privacy has never been harder. Many companies decide it's in their best interest to permit a reasonable amount of personal use of company phones and email. But firms can be sued if their employees use the company's email or internet access to bring offensive material into the workplace. Technology makes it possible to keep close track of employee activities, even down to the individual keystroke. But in an era of tight labor markets, companies have to balance vigilance against the specter of Big Brother. Jack Sheehan is a spokesman for Twin Cities-based General Mills, which tells employees their emails and web use may be subject to monitoring.
We would not want the perception among employees that their every single move is being watched. Nobody wants to work under conditions like that, and certainly we don't want to do that at General Mills. However, if it is in our interests, and if it is in the business interests, we have the capability and the right, if we so desire, to pay closer attention to what people do on email and on the internet.
Monitoring may discourage inappropriate use of electronic communications, but it can also cause a chain reaction of unexpected consequences. Kenneth Goodpaster, coach professor of business ethics at the University of St. Thomas in the Twin Cities, found a company willing to divulge its experience in exchange for anonymity. Using the alias Waterby Toys, Goodpaster turned the company's story into a case study for students. Concern about preserving trade secrets led the company to begin tracking employee use of the internet. Goodpaster says no security concerns emerged after the first week.
Much to their surprise, there were a significant number of employees who were accessing sites that were inappropriate, either because they were pornographic or because they were objectionable in other ways. And in particular, there was one employee who apparently had been logged on for 8 solid hours in one day to a clearly pornographic site, and the site was clearly spelled out on the printout.
Personal web surfing on company time appears to be on the rise. One survey conducted by a firm that makes tracking software suggests workers' non-work-related surfing rose from 15% to 30% of total internet use in the last year. At Waterby Toys, Goodpaster says the revelations about workers' web browsing led security officials to reverse course and argue for scrapping the monitoring. They said there wasn't enough of a security risk to justify what they were finding out. But Goodpaster says they could not turn back.
The corporate general counsel saw in this another kind of danger that hadn't even crossed their mind.
The computer logged onto the pornographic website was potentially visible to other employees. Goodpaster says the company could not just ignore a situation that could open the firm to charges of creating a hostile work environment.
Once they caught problems that were arguably illegalities, or potentially so, then simply deciding, well, we're not going to monitor anymore, with the knowledge that these activities were going on, would have put the company in a very precarious position if there had been a lawsuit.
Waterby Toys fired the worker with a taste for pornography, someone who had been in good standing, and decided to continue keeping tabs on internet use for the time being. Waterby is not alone. Xerox installed a new monitoring system last spring and has fired at least 40 employees for looking at pornographic websites while on the job. John Roberts, an attorney in Minneapolis, says companies are often shocked by what they uncover. He says he's worked on a case in which a company's engineers were casually sending their software ideas to the competition's engineers in emails.
These engineers, we talked to them, good, solid people, people that were top performers. We said, well, you know, this is 100 lines of code out of a 10 million line system. Who cares? And yeah, we trade stuff all the time. And they never thought about the implications, the proprietary rights, the patent rights, the copyright, trademark, the trade secret issues that went along with that.
Many employment law attorneys say companies are generally reluctant to spy on employees. But as the potential perils of the internet age come into clearer focus, electronic monitoring of employees is spreading, according to an American Management Association survey. In 2 years, the percentage of companies saying they check employee email, computer files, and phone calls grew 10 points to 45%. Much of that from a sharp increase in email tracking. A host of companies offering monitoring software is trying to capitalize on the trend, confident it will continue.
I think it's a phenomenal business opportunity.
Matt Kramer is with Twin Cities-based Control Data Systems. The firm sells a service that allows companies to analyze their email traffic. Kramer says it can cost as little as 50 cents a month to keep an eye on one email box or address. And worldwide, the number of email boxes in use grows at rates exceeding 200 million per year. Matt Kramer.
When you look at companies' use of email and their concern about how email is used or could be used, both from a positive and potentially a negative standpoint, this is a fantastic business segment to be in.
Hello, this is the phone mail system. Dial your password and then push enter or pound.
Many offices are full of technology with security features like passwords and user IDs that convey the illusion of privacy. But voicemail or email passwords do not bar company administrators. Minneapolis attorney Marshall Tanick says the walls of privacy are crumbling because technology has made it easier for employers to snoop.
I've had at least a half dozen cases where people have had voicemail messages that the employers have overheard that led to them getting into trouble at the workplace. For instance, one case, it was a call from a prospective employer soliciting this person to seek out work at a competitive company, and that was left on a voicemail. An employer overheard it and took action against the employee because of it.
Many employment law attorneys say companies should tell workers they may be monitored, largely because that makes it harder for someone to claim an invasion of privacy. The American Management Association survey found that most companies do inform their employees, but notification about email and voicemail surveillance actually declined in the last year. Last month, California Governor Gray Davis vetoed a bill requiring companies to tell workers about email monitoring. On the other hand, the Minnesota Supreme Court recognized a right to privacy for the first time last year, but it remains unclear what practical effect this ruling will have in the workplace. If the law is unclear, the technology leaves little room for doubt. Matt Kramer of Control Data Systems says any sense that email, for example, is private is an illusion.
I can take my machine, I can take it out in the parking lot, I can run over it with a car, I can throw it in the bottom of the swamp, never to be recovered again, and it still doesn't matter because copies of my email that I sent to other people are sitting on servers all over the world.
Kramer ends with a warning. Never write an email you'd regret seeing on a billboard with your name on it. I'm Bill Catlin, Minnesota Public Radio.
Well, joining us now to discuss workplace privacy and to take your questions are two Minnesota attorneys who've worked in this area. Greg Corwin is a labor lawyer with Corwin & Associates. Richard Ross is the chair of the Labor and Employment Law Department at Frederickson & Byron. Both of them serve on the governing council of the State Bar's Labor and Employment Law Section. And, of course, we invite you to join our conversation as well. We're talking about workplace privacy this hour of midday. And if you have a question or comment, give us a call here, 651-227-6000, 651-227-6000. Outside the Twin Cities, you can reach us toll-free. That number is 1-800-242-2828. 651-227-6000 or 1-800-242-2828. Gentlemen, thanks for coming by today.
Thank you, Gary.
Thank you.
Richard Ross, do employees have any rights, privacy rights whatsoever in the workplace?
Certainly. I think they have many rights. The problem that they have is if they have an expectation of privacy, then I think they have good rights. If they don't have an expectation of privacy, then the employer does have the right and can check the email, voicemail, all the things that we heard about in Bill's report.
Explain a little more.
Well, the invasion of privacy cause of action, which the Minnesota Supreme Court recognized last year, basically requires, as do many of the statutes that that deal with this issue requires that the employer put the employee on notice that they could be subject to review, the emails, the voicemails, those kinds of things. It's kind of like having a locker. If you have a locker and the employer has the key to the locker, you have no expectation of privacy. The employer is going to have access to it. If the employer gives you a locker and lets you use your own lock, that the employer has no access to, then you have an expectation of privacy. So that's really where the rubber hits the road.
So if the employer does not tell the employee that, well, we might be monitoring, they really can't monitor.
I think that's right. I think the statutes, there are both federal and state statutes that deal with electronic interception that specifically require the employer to give that advice and get it, not necessarily get the consent of the employee, but just to let them know and have them acknowledge that that they have that right.
Greg Corwin, any idea how widespread this monitoring is here in Minnesota? Apparently two-thirds of U.S. businesses report that they're involved in this in one fashion or another. Similar in Minnesota?
Our experience is that most employers of any size that have any kind of sophisticated email, voicemail system monitor to some extent. I think both in terms of the legal advice that they're getting and in terms of just the practical caution that most employers have leads them to monitor. We've had cases where employees have claimed a hostile work environment because they've seen pornographic material on other people's computer screens that they've dialed up from the internet. We've had people that have been disciplined for comments that they've made in emails that they probably never would have made face-to-face or in writing, but somehow feel that they have some security or expectation of privacy in writing these emails back and forth, and they're being disciplined. The state of Minnesota took on the state professional union of 10,000 employees for using the state's email and computer system to distribute positions on political issues that were before the state legislature, and the state actually threatened to take away my client's email privileges and use of the state system because they felt that by conveying to our members over the state system positions on political issues, that somehow was using the state for partisan political purposes.
And that's all okay as long as they've told the employees that, well, we might do this.
Well, in the state's position was that they had a very elaborate email policy, and they claimed that that violated their policy, and that's, I think, where Rick gets involved. And I think employers more and more need not only to notify employees, but they need to have written policies and procedures governing the use of email, voicemail, any kind of electronic communication, so that employees are put on notice as to what their rights, responsibilities are, and what are the consequences for improper use, and what is improper use.
Mm-hmm. I think when people often think about this issue of workplace privacy, the assumption is that the employer is somehow the bad guy here, and if not Big Brother, then Big Brother's cousin or something. On the other hand, there is this issue of employers having to protect themselves from the behavior of their employees. Is there any employer who dare not monitor their employees anymore?
I think there's a real risk there. Matt Kramer's comment it was very telling. We routinely in litigation now get requests for copies of email that might have anything to do with the subject matter of the lawsuit. And quite frankly, all of that information is stored somewhere, not just on that local hard drive. It's on the backup server, and if you sent it out over the internet, it's on somebody else's server. So all that information is available and can be used against the employer or an employee in the context of an employment litigation case. So yeah, there's a real risk that employers run by not having a policy and not enforcing that policy.
Let's say that an employee has fired off that email and really said some nasty things about the boss or whatever. You know, they get mad and type it up to the buddy down the hall. Is there any way that employee could be protected? Any way they can cover themselves?
They really can't. And you know, one thing about email is that once it's sent, you can't take it back. It's not like typing a piece of paper and then throwing the piece of paper away, or throwing the carbon away, or throwing the copies away, or retracting or taking it back somehow. once it gets into those computer systems, you lose control of it. And employees have to understand that statements, comments, anything they say over the email are not privileged. They're not protected. They can be sued both by the subject of the email and perhaps by the or disciplined by the employer as well. We've had people with marital disputes, all sorts of affairs that have been going on, and people making accusations back and forth all over the company's email system. And then one of the parties gets mad at the company as well for fostering this and allowing this, and it was on the company's computer system, and it was printed out with the company's printer, and somehow the company has some liability. Now, one of the interesting things that Rick talked about that I think can turn the other way is if the company does have a monitoring policy and doesn't enforce it, that may subject the company to liability. If the company knew that these communications were happening and took no action, the company may have some liability. So if a company is going to have a policy, I would argue it better well enforce it, because having a policy and not enforcing it might be worse than not having a policy at all.
Is there any difference between the way the law treats email and regular mail, regular old paper mail?
Oh, absolutely. Regular old paper mail has enormous protections. If somebody receives personal mail that's clearly personal, that would be a violation of federal law for the employer to open that. On the other hand,
even if they got it at the workplace,
even if they got it at the workplace and it was clearly marked as personal on the outside of the envelope, I think an employer would be at great risk to open that envelope. If it's questionable, then I think you're in a much grayer area and probably not as difficult.
Workplace privacy is the subject this hour of Midday. Our guests, Richard Ross, who is chair of the Labor and Employment Law Department at Fredrickson and Byron. Greg Corwin is with us. He's a labor lawyer with Corwin and Associates. If you'd like to join our conversation, 651-227-6000, outside the Twin Cities, 1-800-242-2828. And while I think of it, just a reminder once again, check out our website, npr.org, and click on Surveillance Society. You'll find a whole raft of information about all of the privacy-related issues we're talking about this week, including a nifty quiz, which I bet you'll fail. Richard, go ahead, please.
Yeah, hi, my name is Richard, and I'm a labor law practitioner in Minneapolis. I have two comments. One is it might be worthwhile for this, the two guests, Greg and Rick, to comment on the distinction between public and private employers, since there are certain constitutional rights which accrue to them, to individuals, and when the state is their employer, they don't necessarily lose their constitutional rights. And the other thing which I think is important to this discussion is the fact that federal law, particularly the National Labor Relations Act, provides protection for employees who get together and engage in what the law calls protected concerted activity. It simply means that if two or more employees get together to raise an issue with their employer, the employer cannot retaliate against them for it. This protection applies whether an employer, whether the employees are members of a union or not. And the National Labor Relations Board, which is charged with administration of this act, has held that issues of workplace surveillance, which relate directly to privacy issues, are matters of mandatory bargaining, which means that the employer must discuss the matter with the union if the employees are unionized. It would also mean that if two or three non-unionized employees wanted to talk to the employer about the surveillance system, how it's used, what happens to the tapes, that is something which the employer must discuss with them and cannot discipline them for. I would believe that this is going to be extended to the other forms of electronic monitoring, and I think that this is something which probably should be discussed in terms of what kind of protections the employees have in the workplace. I will hang up and listen.
All right. Thanks for your suggestions.
Greg, why don't you take the constitutional issue?
I represent most of the public employees who are organized in the state, and there's always an old saw we say in litigation, and that says that public employees don't have all the rights of every other citizen in this country. But the caller is right. Because the employer is the government is bound by the Bill of Rights. It's bound by the First Amendment. It's bound by the Due Process Clause. And so it must act accordingly, even with respect to its own employees. However, First of all, free speech isn't unlimited. The first thing you learn in law school is you can't call out for a fire in the middle of a crowded theater. And public employees' free speech rights have been severely limited by the Supreme Court. Public employees can't even criticize their employers without suffering some discipline if it goes outside the scope of their normal employment relationship. They may be able to do that, but if it in any way relates to their employment relationship, they can't. And we're talking about use of a computer system that's owned by the public employer and supposedly to be used for official state business or official public business, and using the public's communication apparatus for partisan political activities is not protected by the First Amendment. So in many of the areas I'm talking about, for example, the MAPE case I talked about, where we were talking about our positions on legislative issues, there it was legitimate and not a violation of the First Amendment for the state to raise the concern that you're using the state apparatus, state equipment and so on, for partisan political reasons. So there are some limitations on public employees, even though with respect to the issue of the First Amendment and freedom of speech and assembly and so on, we have rights that the private sector employees don't have because there is no state action. The employer is not the government, and therefore the Due Process Clause and the First Amendment don't apply. But that doesn't mean that in this area it means that public employees have some expanded rights that their private sector cohorts don't have.
Second part of the caller's question there, it sounded like he's suggesting that if I'm going to fire off that email about my boss, if I could get old Harry down the hall to sign on with me, we'd be in good shape.
Well, actually, I'm not sure you even need to have a second person sign on. Richard is correct. There is the core of the National Labor Relations Act protects what's called concerted protected activity. And if an employee sends an email that deals with the terms, conditions, and privileges of employment, for example, the air conditioning is not working well and it's too hot in here, and that could be, if it goes out to other employees and there's a response to that, that could be considered protected concerted activity. And if the employer disciplines that employee for that comment, that might be a violation of the National Labor Relations Act. The substance of what is communicated can give rise to protection. And in addition to the National Labor Relations Act, you have the Whistleblower Act, you have various other retaliatory statutes such as workers' compensation, OSHA, etc. So there are, depending on the substance of what's in the email, there could be certain protections that that flow to that to the person. The second part of Richard's question is also correct, that I think it is what is called a mandatory subject of bargaining. In those employment situations where there is a union that represents certain employees, that union has the exclusive right to represent those employees with respect to all those terms, conditions, and privileges of employment. Well, certainly monitoring electronic communications, email, voicemail, and those things is a term and condition or privilege of employment, and the employer would be obligated to negotiate in good faith over what that policy would be, just like any other policy.
Workplace privacy is our subject this hour of midday, and joining us here in the studio, a couple of Minnesota attorneys who've been working in this area, Greg Corwin, who's with Corwin and Associates, Richard Ross, who's with Fredrickson and Byron. And again, we invite you to join our conversation. Give us a call here, 651-227-6000, 651-227-6000. If you're calling from outside the Twin Cities, you can reach us toll-free. That number is 1-800-242-2828, and we'll get to some more callers in a couple of minutes. Before we go back to our callers, is in general, recognizing this is kind of hard to generalize about, but in general, are employers more concerned about employees using their equipment improperly or using their time improperly on the job?
I'd say it's probably both. It's interesting. Technology has obviously increased productivity in the workplace enormously. And the other side to that is, however, we find that people are using, for example, the internet for their own personal reasons to go shopping or whatever. And that does take away from their productivity. So that would clearly be a primary concern. I think a secondary concern would be the improper use of the equipment. I think we can all look back before this technology explosion to telephones. And the policies typically were, in most places, not to use the telephone for personal business unless it was an emergency. And I think even though that was the stated policy, I think most employers permitted some level of personal use. And when it went over a reasonable amount, then employers would react and discipline. So it's probably both the use of the equipment and the time that's lost.
Mm-hmm. Joel, your question, please.
Just a quick one. You talk about email being written in stone forever. What about my kids and all the stuff they do on instant mail and chat rooms? Do I have a reason to be concerned about that sticking around forever?
Well, I think you do, and that's the problem. With these computers, once you put something in a system, especially with the internet, where it's going through many different computer systems all over the country, that information is out there. And whether it's in a chat room or wherever it is, once it leaves your computer and goes on that internet, it's available to anyone who's interested, I suppose. And that's what we're concerned about in the workplace, is that communications within a company used to be within a company or within a governmental subdivision, and either you communicated through interoffice memos or through the telephone, but the communication stayed within the boundaries of the company. Now, the communication that you're using to communicate within the company is actually going all over the world through the various computer servers and so on. And so the medium that you're using to communicate is no longer within the sole control of the company. It's going everywhere. And the other thing is that when you communicate on the phone, normally you only have two parties of conversation. When you communicate by email, anybody can pick up that email. If you go to a site, anyone can pick it up, and everybody's got computer screens, and they're all out in the open, and people walk by and look to see what's on your screen, or you look to see what's on their screen. And so the whole matrix for communication is extended to the point where your communication is open to anyone. And as a result, I think you have to start developing a mindset that you better be more circumspect in what you are communicating. And it seems to be just the opposite, that people say things on the computer because they're talking to this machine that they would never say to a person face-to-face or put in writing. So it's just the opposite.
Joel, your question, please.
Thank you. It's more of a comment than it is a question, and you're starting to get close to what I'm thinking about, and that is that when an employee, whether they be private or public, uses the assets of the corporation or the government entity for some purpose that doesn't relate to their job, they're stealing. And then they compound that by using the time, which the employer is paying them for, to do a job for some function that doesn't relate to the job. Thanks. I'll hang up and listen.
I think that your comment is well taken. I think we have to use a rule of reasonableness, however. Employers have tolerated for years people using paper clips and number two pencils for their own personal purposes.
But if your boss was a real hard nose, he or she could crack down on you for this, right?
Absolutely. But I think most employers have not. And so I think what's going to, you know, we're in uncharted waters here, especially when it comes to the technology that we're dealing with. I think we're going to hit a level of reasonableness like we have with other supplies and equipment. I mean, people come to work, they use the photocopy machine to copy their personal documents. It happens. And even if employers have policies, one, it's almost impossible to police because you can't be everywhere at all times. Mm-hmm. And two, most employers don't want to be, Orwellian about their environment.
Now, Joel called on a car phone, it sounded like. if you are driving around on for your company and you've got a phone, can the company monitor your calls? Make sure that you're just not calling radio stations, but just calling your next client?
Well, here's what's interesting. You know, the Bar Association's had a problem dealing with this, and so has the Board of Professional Responsibility. And they've told us, for example, that if we're going to use a cellular phone to talk to our clients, it better be a digital one so it is encrypted and it can't be intercepted. And we've got to be careful about communicating attorney-client privileged items on the Internet and in emails. We may waive. In fact, there's an article I was just reading before we came on here about the waiver of the attorney-client privilege by putting things on the Internet. So it is a problem. And if you're on an analog cellular phone, people can and will listen in on your conversations. And to the extent that you're engaged in business conversations, you could, for example, give out business secrets or privileged information about your company, and it's intercepted by someone because you were speaking on a cell phone.
Yeah, the technology exists. You can buy scanners today that will pick up and intercept analog cellular phones as well as cordless phones in your home.
Is that legal?
Well, in some states it is, depending on which state you're in. But if you are a party to the conversation, clearly you can record it and make use of it. If you're not a party, then there are some problems.
Now, I should point out that our midday listeners would never do anything like that. Joel, for example, a midday listener, did call back right away to say he was on his own phone on his own time. Joe's on the line from Grand Rapids. Go ahead, Joe.
Thank you. I'm using my own cell phone, but it is plugged into the cigarette lighter using the battery power from the company vehicle. So I'm really in a can of worms here. My question, comment, or theory, if you will, is back to the previous caller. And that is, if a company has a policy or lack of policy that says you are or are not allowed to use paperclips, computers, et cetera, if you are allowed to use it, where are your First Amendment rights since you have permission to use these things for personal use or not? And, you know, that seems to be the question for me to ponder. I'll hang up and listen. Thank you very much.
Well, remember that in the private sector, you don't have First Amendment rights. You're working for a private employer. They're not bound by the First Amendment. So companies can have rules and regulations as long as they're reasonable. And one of the things I wanted to point out, too, is when you talk about enforcing this, some of our callers have said, well, the company should enforce this policy strictly. There has to be uniformity in any kind of enforcement or discipline. That's one of the things that labor lawyers on the union side look at. Was there consistency? Was there prior notice? Is the company enforcing its policy equally among all the employees? And I think what Rick is saying is that you can't possibly discipline every employee every time they misuse the system. You can't be consistent. It'll look like you're picking on someone, and heaven forbid if it's a person who's in a protected class, there's all sorts of liability if you treat them differently than or disparately from other people. So there has to be this rule of reasonableness, because otherwise you're leaving yourself open for even more problems or liability.
And we get those charges. We do see them where they say, well, so-and-so was using the computer for personal purposes, and the employer says, but we had no knowledge of that.
Mm-hmm. Medical records, an area of great concern, I think, to a lot of people. I guess, first of all, do employers have access to all the employees' medical records?
I would say generally no. In certain circumstances, yes, and it's limited. In the context of worker compensation claims, the employer may be privy to some but not all of the medical records relative to that claim. Beyond that, employers might have, for example, documentation from physicians or medical providers as to restrictions in the workplace, those kinds of things. Beyond that, employers generally will not have access to most medical information in the normal circumstances.
So even if they're paying the freight, the employer, they wouldn't necessarily have your records.
That's correct.
That's right. There's a very famous case that I used in the seminar on our new right to privacy that the Supreme Court has established in the Walmart case, where an employee was seeking to have a medical leave of absence and giving the reasons out. And supervisor not only called her husband to check on whether these reasons were the right reasons and to tell her what was going on, but passed on these medical opinions to other people in the company without her permission. So that originally the issue was legitimate, that is, her reasons for a leave of absence and the medical conditions which would govern her coming back to work and accommodations that would have to be made for her coming back to work. But then the company, by spreading that information to people who really didn't have a need to know, even as far as to her spouse, created a situation where it invaded her privacy, and the court ruled that the company was liable. So it's not only access to the medical records, it's how they're used, who sees them, and how they're protected from being viewed by people who shouldn't see them. So where a company may have a legitimate need to know why you need an accommodation for something, or why you can't be at work for an extended period of time, or what kind of illness you have, its use of that material and its distribution of that material may subject it to liability.
And can employees reasonably expect that those boundaries will be observed, or is that one of those things that's, in theory, the way it's supposed to work, but in practice, if your boss finds out you've got condition X, you're toast.
I think in theory and in practice, to my experience, it has been true to form. I think employers tend to be very sensitive to these issues, and both the Americans with Disabilities Act, the Minnesota Human Rights Act, the Family and Medical Leave Act, all require and provide for the security and separate maintenance of any medical records that the employer may have. It's limited use, limited access, and only to be used, as Greg referenced, to those people who have a need to know. For example, if you have an employee that is a diabetic, and the employer might need to know that for the purpose if that person goes into diabetic shock, so that his or her immediate supervisor has sufficient information, or the people who are responsible know how to react to that situation. So there are circumstances where it's critical and, mm-hmm. and maybe life-threatening for an employer to have that information. Again, I think my experience generally is employers are very sensitive to that, and I've not seen very much activity where it's been abused.
Leslie, your question, please.
Hi. Well, this is more of a comment, and I'll take your response off the air, but it's a bit of a story. When I was living out of state, I had an acquaintance who was just fired from his job at a state job that they tracked that he had viewed a pornography site, and he was fired immediately with no recourse given. There was no way for him to argue it. He said, "I didn't do it, really. I mean, maybe I did it by mistake, but you know, it wasn't intentional." And he was fired immediately. And I think that's very scary legally, especially because just the other day when I was at work and I was on the internet for my job, I typed in a reverse directory address that I thought would take me to a reverse directory, and it was one of those links that took me to a pornography site. And how scary. I immediately told my office administrator because I know that they track those things. Mm-hmm. But it's just so legally slippery because there's no way to defend yourself against it.
Is there any way to defend yourself against something like that?
Well, from the labor side of the picture, we always argue intent. That's one of our best defenses, that we didn't mean it or whatever. But I don't think most employers would simply on a per se basis fire someone because there was one instance of access to some pornographic site. I think they would look to the frequency of the violation. I think they would look to how serious it was. I think they would look to see what the effect on other employees were. Did other employees see that site? But a single occasion for a very limited period of time, that's very unusual that you would see a discharge situation there. There's either more to the story or you have an employer that needs to get some advice.
Mm-hmm. I would agree with that. I think there's another issue here that we haven't addressed, and that's unsolicited emails that come to you in your office, and some of them just have narratives and some of them have attachments and you don't know what they are. You open it up and all of a sudden there is something that could be considered pornographic and offensive. So unsolicited emails are another problem.
Let's go back to the phones. Mark, your question.
Oh, I just wanted to make two comments. One, it's easy to assume that you're not supposed to use equipment, but if you look at the state of Minnesota, it's perfectly legal. It's in the employee manual for an employee to make local phone calls using a phone. It's not legal to make long-distance calls that incur a cost. And with internet service, where you're not increasing costs when you use it, by and large, to say to the degree people can use it. Second thing is, it is possible to encrypt messages, to encrypt email messages, to provide a high level of security. And in work environments where people are concerned about being able to view others' work screens, if that becomes a work-related issue, the federal government in the Pentagon pioneered polarized filters for computer screens that only allow the person in front of it to see it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's not as if there aren't solutions out there for many of these problems.
Agreed.
Probably the technology exists. I'm not familiar with the Pentagon, of course. But your comment about local and long-distance calls, I certainly defer to Greg as far as public employment. But I do know that obviously in the private sector, and I'm assuming in the public sector, if you make a long-distance phone call, there is a record of that. And private employers will, if you don't have the right to make those long-distance calls, come back to you and say, on this date at this time, you made a long-distance call to this number. Was it business-related? If not, reimburse us for it.
We just had a big controversy in state government with members of the state patrol who are all issued cell phones. In misuse of them for, and there again, that could be a criminal act, because there you're misusing government funds, you're stealing from the government by using the state-issued cell phone for personal calls. And what people have to realize is not only can you track the fact that they're personal calls, but you can track who they're to. So in one case, they were tracking a guy who was calling his girlfriend and who was otherwise married and got himself into all sorts of problems. So these electronic means are much easier to track. But it is true that especially in the government situation, there's potential criminal liability for the misuse of government property for personal use or personal gain.
We started this hour by noting that this is not a new phenomena, this whole business of workplace privacy. Henry Ford, of course, had spies out checking on people. In general, are employers only concerned with workplace-related issues, or is there some danger that many employers will move beyond whether or not you're actually showing up for the assembly line and checking on, you know, your political beliefs, your sexual orientation, whatever it may be?
I don't think employers have the resources or the desire to do that. There are specific laws in Minnesota, for example, and other states that prohibit employers from delving into legitimate non-work activities, commonly referred to as the smoker's rights bill, that allows employees, when they're not working and not on the premises, to engage in lawful activities. So there are protections for employees. I don't think that employers ought to care, actually, as to what employees do off the job, as long as when they come to work, they're productive. And if they did something off the job that caused them to not be productive and not to be able to focus, then that becomes an issue. And yes, in that circumstance, an employer should have some rights.
Mm-hmm.
It's a little different in the public sector. Off-duty conduct can be the subject of discipline and even dismissal if it reflects negatively against either the public employer or the employee. For example, a police officer is picked up for a DWI. A police officer can be fired for engaging in criminal activity because a police officer is held to a higher standard. Or people that are entrusted with the government funds, auditors and so on, who cheat on their taxes.
Mm-hmm.
So off-duty conduct can be the subject of discipline for public employees, and therefore the employers can argue that their monitoring of that off-duty conduct may be legitimate if they have some kind of probable cause to believe that something is happening. And in fact, public employers do monitor the off-duty activities of their employees.
I think that's also somewhat true for a private sector.
Gentlemen, we're out of time, unfortunately. A lot more to talk about, but appreciate your coming in today.
Thank you, Greg.
Thank you.
Greg Corwin, who is with Corwin & Associates, Richard Ross, who's with Fredrickson & Byron, stopping by today to talk about privacy in the workplace.